Let's talk about online privacy, or the lack of it. Facebook, Google, and many other internet services ask you to accept privacy policies. And the other day I had an experience which suggested to me what that might feel like if it happened in my life away from my devices. I had asked NPR science correspondent Shankar Vedantam into my office. I just wanted to chat. He's an interesting guy, but I was surprised when he showed up at the door with a 35-page stack of paper.
I just have this quick privacy policy I'd like you to read over and sign.
This is like a stack of paper here.
Yeah, here's a pen. All you have to do is just sign on the last sheet.
Okay, just because you're telling me, I'm going to sign this, because time is short.
Thank you so much.
So I signed it the same way that I click I accept on those endless online privacy policies. And then afterwards, Shankar began standing around my office, making observations.
This is Steve Inskeep, white male, 6'2", latitude 38.901951, desk extremely cluttered, checking some of the emails that have been printed out and laid on the desk next to him.
Excuse me, Shankar, you're kind of invading my space here.
Actually talked about that during the privacy policy, Steve, so we're actually all good about that. Nothing to worry about, totally.
Talked about that during the privacy policy?
Yes,
I don't remember discussing
this is actually
that.
Something that we discussed during the privacy policy. His left leg is crossed over his right leg. His screensaver has a picture of what looks like a little girl.
Yeah, that's my daughter. Thank you very much.
Oh, great. Okay, that's his daughter.
Okay, privacy policy or not, out. Get out.
Little play acting there. Now Shankar Vedantam is back again. And Shankar, that was a lot more unpleasant than just clicking I accept on an online privacy policy.
Well, Steve, what I was trying to illustrate really is that we have very different takes on invasions of our privacy when there's an actual human being who walks into our space, our homes or our offices, and when that invasion of privacy is being done technologically, that we are much more aware of it when there's a human being compared to when it's being done by technology. And, you know, the analogy I have is when you're driving on the street and you see a cop behind you, it's much easier to pay attention to the cop than it is to pay attention to a traffic camera. And that's because evolutionarily, our brains are designed to pay attention to other human beings. Our brains are not designed to pay attention to webcams and cookies and traffic cameras and GPS trackers and JavaScripts and all the other ways in which we're being monitored electronically.
Even though the companies do tell us, I mean, the privacy policy is there, we have to click on something, we know someone's paying attention.
That's exactly right. But of course, as you recall, Steve, you just signed this 35-page document that I placed before you.
Yes.
If you can take a look at page 33 of the policy that I just handed to you, can you read out the last paragraph that's on page 33 of this policy, please?
Find page 33. Okay. Last paragraph.
I, Steve Inskeep, permit Shankar Vedantam to track everything I do at NPR. By signing this policy, I explicitly welcome all intrusions into my personal privacy. I signed that!
You totally signed it, Steve. Why did you sign it?
Because you said to, basically. And it was too long to read, and it's a policy.
That's exactly right. So I spoke with this researcher who studies online privacy at Carnegie Mellon University. Her name is Laurie Craner, and she had something really interesting to say about the number of online privacy policies that are put before the average person in any given year.
If people were to actually stop and read all of them for every website that they visited, they could spend on the order of 200, 250 hours a year. It's about a month of time at work each year that you could spend reading privacy policies.
So my life just gets shorter if I'm trying to guard my privacy. And in the end, I got to click I accept anyway or I can't access the site.
Yeah, you know, actually, when you think about it, it's really a thing of beauty, Steve, which is if you give people things that are really long and difficult to read, most of them won't bother reading it. And of the people who do bother reading it, because the monitoring is silent and happening via technology, they'll quickly forget how intrusive it is.
Is there any doubt that companies go out of their way to make these policies incomprehensible?
I have no comment on that, Steve.
Shankar, drop by any time without the privacy policy.
Sure thing, Steve.
NPR science correspondent Shankar Vedantam, who regularly joins us to talk about social science research, and you can track him on Twitter at Hidden Brain, and while you're at it, you can follow this program at Morning Edition and at NPR Inskeep.
The past year has been one of political upheaval across the Middle East, fueled in part by the spread of information on Twitter and Facebook. So, 1 year after the revolutions began, we're going to check in now on how business is changing for the Arab world tech industry. From Beirut, Tim Fitzsimmons reports.
The Habtor Hotel is packed with hundreds of people wearing the unofficial tech entrepreneur uniform. Open shirt, no tie, jeans, and a blazer. And the conversation sounds like the sort you'd overhear while having lunch at a swanky cafe in the heart of Silicon Valley. Except there's a lot more Arabic.
We are at the ArabNet Digital Summit, the largest gathering for the Arab web and mobile industry.
That's Omar Christidis, founder and CEO of ArabNet. The revolutions got a lot of people logged into Twitter and Facebook, but ArabNet started chipping away at the Middle East's digital disconnect years before the Arab Spring uprisings.
People were not talking to each other from Egypt, from Saudi, from Syria, and there were no real online places where you can find information about what's going on.
This, Omar says, didn't reflect the potential for tech growth in the Middle East.
Internet is booming in the region. When we started the conference in 2010, there were about 35 million users. Today, there's over 70 million users of the internet.
On the other side of the hall, past eager conversations between young entrepreneurs and white robe-clad investors from Gulf states, is Abraham Kmark, an American working for a tech firm in Qatar.
ArabNet is the place to meet other entrepreneurs and investors in the Arab world at this point. It's the hot place right now.
He isn't worried about the political upheaval sweeping the region. If anything, Kmark says, the long-term nature of tech investment means now is as good a time as ever to invest in a place like, say, Egypt.
You would be taking that type of long-term nature and that type of bet in Cairo at this point. If you look at the demographics of the youth, if you look at the internet penetration and the mobile penetration, it's a very attractive market.
Fast forward to Egypt. Beside the River Nile, just outside Cairo, is a stately old apartment building. Behind door number 6 is a tech business incubator called Flat 6 Labs. Tonight, about 20 young men are milling around, eating from buckets of Kentucky Fried Chicken. They're all pretty lucky to be here. Over 60 companies applied for just 7 spots at Flat 6. The selected firms get about $12,000 and 12 weeks to hire a staff, start a company, and find investors. Their proposals range from apps to help tourists connect with locals to an online video learning database for Egyptian students. During their 3-month stint, they refine their business pitches with the help of each other and outside eyes, which is what they're up to tonight.
And the beauty of it is that we're using Twitter.
There's a big difference between somebody who's clever at doing a product and somebody who's running a company. This is where they learn it.
That's Hani Al-Sambati. He's the co-founder of the venture capital firm that set up Flat 6 Labs. He says the whole point of Flat 6 is to make it easier to start tech businesses in Egypt. Things are going well now, but the journey hasn't been totally smooth. Sambati's company was just getting ready to set Flat 6 in motion.
And then the revolution happened.
And so he met with his partner to figure out what to do next.
It was a very short conversation, and there wasn't any compelling reason why not to proceed.
Today, Egypt's economy may still be struggling, but for Flat 6 grads, things are going well. Several companies from the last class are already generating revenue. No one's really sure what's going to happen in Egypt's political and economic future, but Sambati sees one way the revolution impacted the entrepreneurial spirit of the country's young techies.
It emboldened them to follow their ideas, and I have no shadow of a doubt that some of them said, you know what, let's just do this.
For NPR News, I'm Tim Fitzsimmons.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
A computer program designed to score student essays would hate what I've written here. Short sentences, no $5 words, verbless fragments, and another demerit right there for a sentence starting with a word and. But a recent study finds that computers do just as well as humans at scoring essays on standardized tests. We learned all this in an article by the New York Times education columnist Michael Weinrip, who joins me now. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Melissa. Nice to be here.
And let's talk about that study I mentioned. It's from the University of Akron. What did it conclude? It looked at the performance of computer scoring software on essays for standardized tests.
It looked at 16,000 essays from students in 6 states and had 9 automated readers score them and took those results and compared them with human-scored essays and found that there was a high correlation and that in terms of consistency, the automated readers might have done just a little better even.
Consistency meaning not they would look at the same essay and grade it the same way?
That's correct.
And what are they looking for? Are they looking for traits that we would consider to be good writing, or what exactly is it?
Well, they're looking for sentence structure, they're looking for usage, agreement between subjects and verbs, they're looking for sophistication of word use, a lot of the same things that a human editor or reader would look for.
Are they looking for anything that would approximate critical thinking? You know, something that shows, aha, this is a person who's drawn conclusions or has a certain elegance maybe in how they write about them.
That may be a weakness. They're not very, very good on, as the e-rater people who work with it from ETS say, they're not very good on poetry. They're not very good on comprehension. They truly don't understand what they're reading.
Michael, you talked to a director of writing at MIT who tested one of these software programs, the E-Rater, from the Educational Testing Service, and he found a lot of flaws and a lot of ways he could really trip the system up, right?
Yes, if it had anything to do with understanding truth, the system had a big problem. You could say, as he said, that the War of 1812 started in 1945. You could say that the biggest problem we have in America is candy bars that are too long. There are all kinds of things you could say that have little or nothing to do with reality that could receive a high score.
And there are a lot of companies who offer this technology, right? It's not new.
No. It's been going on for quite a while. Pearson, which is the biggest education company in America, virtually every education company has a model. And there's lots of money to be made on this stuff. You know, we're moving towards what's called the Common Core Standards. More and more, under President Obama's race to the top, more and more standardized testing. And so some way, there's got to be some way to keep up with this stuff. And the more homogenized and the more standardized tests, the more that corporations stand to make on all this.
You know, Michael, listening to you, describe this, I'm not sure I can see a value to these computer programs beyond speed and just cranking out results really, really fast. What do you think?
I think it's scary, Melissa. I think that what's scary about it is if this becomes the standard way of correcting these, then teachers are going to teach to them. And a lot of juice of the English language is going to disappear, because if you're not allowed to use a sentence fragment, if you're not allowed to use a short paragraph, sometimes that can be very dramatic. And if those are breaking the rules, you're going to get a more and more homogenized form of writing, when the joy of writing is surprise.
Well, Michael Weinrip, thanks for talking to us about it.
Melissa, thank you for having me.
Michael Weinrip is national education columnist for The New York Times.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.